Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings, my name is Casey Luskin, and I'm here on the ID the Future podcast being broadcast from the Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. And we have on our show today a very distinguished guest, Dr. Michael Egnor, who is professor of neurosurgery and pediatrics at the State University of New York, Stony Brook, and he's also an award-winning surgeon who's been named one of New York's best doctors by New York Magazine. And it's really great to have you on our show today, Dr. Egnor.
Thank you, Casey. I appreciate it.
Well, it seems that every time that I am asked to interview a doctor for the show, I get sick. I actually interviewed Dr. Jeffrey Simmons last month while I had a terrible case of the flu, and last week I had a 103-degree fever for most of the week, so I think it's appropriate that now I'm interviewing you. I know that you are a professor of neurosurgery, so I'm not sure if you have any advice for reducing fevers, but my guess is that you probably have a little bit of experience with those sort of things.
Well, most people don't want to take advantage of my skills, so hopefully it's just the flu.
Yeah, that's right. Hopefully I won't need any of your surgery on me for that, for my fever. But we'd like to talk to a bit today with you is to discuss your sort of drifting from being a Darwinist to a Darwin skeptic and sort of your intellectual conversion that took place. And I'd like to just ask you some questions about that. And I think our listeners would be interested to know about how does, quote unquote, a brain surgeon, or in your case, a professor of neurosurgery, become a Darwin skeptic? So why don't you give us a little bit of background about, were you originally a Darwinist? What was your original view on Darwinism?
Well, ever since I was a kid, I've wanted to be a scientist. And I majored in biochemistry in college and wanted to be a neurosurgeon when I was in medical school. I've been fascinated by science. I found, even as an undergraduate, that learning about biochemistry and learning about molecular biology, I found some aspects of it quite unsatisfying. In a sense that there was so much astonishing complexity, so much sort of beauty in the way life worked at the molecular level, that I couldn't understand how it came to be. And at the time, although I didn't question Darwinism explicitly, because I didn't realize how much evidence there was to support questioning Darwinism, I felt that there was something really missing in my understanding of biological complexity. But I didn't think a whole lot about it and went on to practice neurosurgery and to do my own research. And as time went on, I came to seriously question whether just randomness, just random meaningless events could really generate the kind of beauty and elegance and complexity that's at the core of living things. What troubled me about my attempt to understand where the complexity and sort of the elegance of life came from was a difficulty in seeing how, for example, a genetic code could arise by chance. It seemed to me preposterous to assume that a representational code, which was really a language with letters and words and syntax and punctuation, could arise by random events. No matter how many random events or no matter what kind of selection pressure you offered, we have no experience in nature whatsoever with representational codes or languages, except in biology. And the only experience we have in our lives is with such languages that are intelligently designed and made by people.
It seems like before you even consciously were a Darwin skeptic, you had some seeds of questions in your mind of aspects of biology that just didn't make sense in the light of evolution. Would you say that that's true?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
The difficulty was that I didn't realize that a very powerful scientific case can be made that these aspects of living things are not random. It wasn't until I read the work of Mike Behe, of Bill Dembski, of Philip Johnson, that I came to see that the qualms that I had, the suspicions that I had about the adequacy of Darwinism to explain biological complexity had a very sound scientific basis. And that, in fact, in my view, the science that Behe and Dembski and Johnson were talking about was much better science than the Darwinism that I had been taught.
So was it reading some of the work of leading ID theorists, as you just mentioned, William Dembski, Michael Behe, Philip Johnson, was it reading some of their work that sort of made these questions more explicit and sort of made you more cognizant of the conversion that had already taken place? Is that possibly what happened? Or
okay. It gave language to my suspicions.
Okay.
It allowed this vague feeling that I had to become real, genuine scientific questions.
Okay. Well, so let's talk about those questions just real briefly here. I know you mentioned the ability of random mutation and natural selection to produce the language that we see in the cell. Tell me more about that. How specifically does that challenge a neo-Darwinian explanation in your mind?
What struck me as astonishing in looking at the work of Phil Dembski and Mike Behe and Philip Johnson and all the people who've written on this is that if you look objectively at the genetic code, at much of modern molecular biology, you see a specified complexity, which is really in some sense a semantics, a meaning in, for example, the genetic code. That the gene that codes for an enzyme doesn't itself do what the enzyme does. It doesn't catalyze a reaction. It simply has a meaning that is translated into the enzyme that catalyzes the reaction.
Mm.
How can one generate, by random processes, regardless of what kind of selection pressure you have, because all selection pressure, essentially, has been historically non-intelligent. It gets colder, it gets warmer, a boulder falls on an animal, something happens, but it's not an intelligent cause. But this selection pressure, how can that generate meaning? How can that generate a code, a language? And those questions are very good scientific questions. They're the kinds of questions that Darwinists should have asked in the 1950s immediately when the genetic code was revealed. It's the kind of thing that should have stopped Darwinism in its tracks. It's one thing to propose that animals might get longer fur if the weather turns colder because of natural selection. You know, that's a perfectly reasonable inference. You might infer that bacteria that had mutations that in some accidental way prevented them from being killed by antibiotics might have evolved resistance to antibiotics. Those are all plausible. I'm not sure they're so well proven, but they're plausible. But the question as to how you got a representational language, molecules that actually have semantics, that have meaning, that give rise to life, and the question as to how you could achieve that by random processes is a very, very good scientific question. And it's a question that should have been asked if Darwinists had been objective about their work immediately when the genetic code was discovered. Instead, all they did was they made the same kind of facile assumptions that they had been making about all kinds of evolution and simply applied the same sort of stories, the just-so stories, to molecular evolution. Mm. And I think that finally good scientists are starting to come around and say, wait a minute, there's been a serious mistake made in terms of understanding this process. We need to go back and look at this again.
Well, this is very interesting, and I think we're going to talk some more about your scientific questions about evolution and whether they are being answered adequately by the Darwinists in an upcoming podcast. But for now, Dr. Agnor, thank you very much for telling us a little about the reasons that you came to become a Darwin skeptic, and I hope we can have you back on the show soon.
Great. Thank you, Casey.
This is Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast. Thank you for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.